Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop. Today's program is part one of a three-part series on living with prostate cancer, and today's topic is highlights of precision medicine, its implications for the treatment of prostate cancer. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 792 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, Egypt, India, Iran, Korea, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So this is a bit of an international call, really, with all of you on the call, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's activity was made possible by Genomic Health, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this very important topic and this program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin, and Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. Dr. Slovin is a wonderfully frequent speaker on these programs and really a great colleague, I have to say, over these many years. And Dr. Slovin is going to address, again, an overview of prostate cancer, including its current standard of care, innovations in biomarker testing and molecular profiling of prostate cancer, the role of precision medicine in improving treatment decisions, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's always a pleasure being on the call, and good afternoon to everyone, ladies and gentlemen. I hope I can be helpful to you in terms of understanding and perhaps going forward with new and innovative treatments for those people who have prostate cancer. Per Carolyn's request, I think it's always important to just start off with the standards of care and what's available for people in the outpatient setting. Excuse me, I beg your pardon. And to keep in mind that the standards of care still prevail, but there are nuances that are out there now to help us understand perhaps very early on the biology of the cancer. So while surgery and radiation, be it external beam or seed implant, still remain the standards of care for patients with localized prostate cancer, that is, disease that remains within the confines of the gland, surgery and radiation still continue to be the standards of care. However, what we're seeing now is an effort to have active surveillance for those patients whose prostate cancer may not be of significant biologic concern, meaning a very low PSA, or very, very few cores of the biopsy that are involved with cancer. And for those patients, they can be monitored every 6 to 12 months with repeat biopsies and may have a very normal oncologic life, meaning that they may never need treatment or may need treatment many months to years later. Now, where we get into areas where there's a lot of excitement has to do with patients whose disease returns after primary therapy, such as surgery or radiation. That means that either the PSA has returned and new disease may have shown up on imaging, such as disease in bone or lymph nodes, while people can enjoy very long-term treatment benefits as a result of standard treatment such as hormonal therapy, we find that the greatest challenge is how to treat a patient whose cancer does not respond any longer to standard hormonal therapy. And by that, we're talking about the GnRH analog or antagonist, goes by the name of either leuprolide or degarelix. And perhaps they've been on an antiandrogen such as bicalutamide or nilutamide, respectively known as Casodex or Nilandron. And what ends up happening is that either the PSA continues to rise despite being on those first-line drugs, or their disease gets worse, or both. And when that happens, we have a whole armamentarium of new treatments, and really, I don't remember the last time that within a five-year period we've had so many new drugs. Many people have expressed interest in knowing more about immune therapies, given all the new information being provided in non-small cell lung cancer, melanoma, and kidney cancer, and that happens to be the drug Provenge or Cipolucel-T. That's a cellular product immunotherapy, which is derived from the patient's own white blood cells. The cells are incubated together with a protein that stimulates the development of what we call dendritic cells. These are cells that present novel molecules to the immune system so that the immune system knows how to develop an anti-tumor effect. This drug was probably the premier immune therapy in that it showed a benefit overall in terms of cancer control. However, for some patients, it was advantageous. For others, it turns out that the durability of response was very limited. Now, this is something that can be used. It has minimal side effects except for the time that you receive your own cells back. Other treatments that are out there now have to do with novel, what we call AR-directed therapy against the androgen receptor. That's the molecule on the tumor cell to which testosterone has been binding all those years to stimulate its growth. Well, we've learned since then that even though we have given drugs to reduce the serum testosterone, meaning to try to castrate the patient and starve the tumor, the actual tumor cell itself is starting to rev up and starts to produce testosterone due to overactivity of this particular molecule called the androgen receptor. Two drugs, enzalutamide, the other name for it is Xtandi, and abiraterone, the other name for that is Zytiga, have been shown to be significantly beneficial, but even though they're oral medications, well-tolerated, there still is some controversy as to which drug should be used first. They're both equally effective. Some people would argue that if you've been on a variety of different anti-androgens, such as bicalutamide or nicalutamide, that you can go directly to abiraterone. For others, enzalutamide might be more gentle since it doesn't require giving prednisone along with it. But they are both very effective drugs and well tolerated. We just don't know the best way of strategizing this as yet. In other words, which one to be given first. Sometimes it's just clinical judgment, but there are clinical trials that are ongoing trying to make it a little easier for us to understand who would derive benefit from these drugs in the first line or second line setting. Another approach is toward treating metastatic disease that's no longer responding to therapy is such as the hormonal therapy. We dose a Taxol, otherwise called Taxotere. This drug has been around for a very long time, and I've seen tremendous responses to this drug. It's intravenous, given every 3 weeks, and minimal side effects. However, more recently, for those patients who failed docetaxel, cabazitaxel, or Gevtana, is a second-line treatment, chemotherapy, and again, given every 3 weeks, and it too can salvage those patients who have not responded well to docetaxel. Should somebody have symptoms as a result of their cancer, a new drug has been approved called radium-223 or Zofigo, and this drug has also helped with the symptoms that are relevant to cancer pain from disease progression. Now, what's very interesting in terms of the treatment landscape is that while we do have established guidelines, and many of you have heard of the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, these are guidelines. They're not etched in stone, but they are guidelines to give us suggestions how to proceed in a particular treatment algorithm or menu. However, that doesn't mean we can't be creative in mixing and matching. And that's where clinical trials come in. So I always have patients who ask me when they should go on a clinical trial. And I'm very very strongly in favor of starting a clinical trial because it can change the biology of your cancer early on such that you may be much more receptive to other drugs down the line. What we are learning now is that there are other ways by which we can understand the biology of the cancer. We very strongly recommend that as the cancer starts to fail specific therapies, that one do biopsies of available sites such as lymph node or bone on patients. And the reason is that we are learning about changes or mutations in the genetic background of the cancer. So not every metastatic focus is the same. They all have different genetics. And so we are learning via genomic evaluations how to get to know the biology of the cancer. And this is where personalized medicine has started to come into use. So many of you have heard of personalized medicine. I get a lot of questions from patients wanting to know if they send their piece of tissue off to some place on the internet that they will be guaranteed that they'll have an idea of how which drugs are going to work. It's not necessarily the case, and many of these places are not validated. But more broadly speaking, personalized medicine, also known as precision medicine, can be thought more of the tailoring of a medical treatment to a individual's characteristics, that's biologic characteristics, or preferences during all stages of care, and that includes prevention, diagnosis, treatment, and even follow-up. Some people will say personalized medicine should be getting the right patient with the right drug, at the right dose, at the right time. Others may say that it's the tailoring of a medical treatment to the individual characteristics of each patient, or trying to get to know about the patient's genes and proteins and environment to diagnose, prevent, and treat the cancer. So we are now using a lot of different technologies to understand how the cancer behaves from its incipience to its resistance to standard therapies. So many of you may have heard of OncoDX or Oncotype in breast cancer, which is used at diagnosis. We actually have this for prostate cancer, where it may be of some help in guiding the immediacy of treatment. But more importantly, we are doing biopsies throughout the entire clinical course of the cancer, from diagnosis to, for example, development of metastatic disease, to development of resistance to multiple therapies. And each time, we are trying to learn about which are the actionable, as we call it, mutations or changes. And that helps us guide what treatments may be custom-tailored for the patient. But there are pros and cons to this. It's not as straightforward as people would like to think, because the cancer cells are very smart. Not only will they respond to a therapy initially, but they will become very resistant. If you block in one sense one particular pathway, the cell is very smart and will develop a collateral pathway. So it may very well be that while we understand that there are genomic changes, it may not be that one drug will fit each pathway. We may have to do combination therapies. We're also looking at circulating tumor cells from patients with metastatic disease. These are thought to be shed cells from the original tumor. And we're looking for genomic changes or changes in expression of the androgen receptor. So really what we're trying to do is getting to know the biology of your cancer from the day you walk in to the day that you become resistant. Now, this involves a multidisciplinary healthcare team. This involves people in the laboratory. It involves people at every course of your care, from radiation oncology to urology to even ancillary services such as rehabilitation medicine, psychiatry. Everybody gets involved because we all want to take care of the patient in the most comprehensive way possible. What's the right answer for each person is going to differ. We do have concepts, meaning we need everything that we glean is about populations. But when it comes down to using the appropriate drug, it's going to be on an individual basis. So I'm going to stop here right now. Happy to answer questions later and turn it right back to you, Carolyn. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Slovin. That was really outstanding and very comprehensive. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Indeed, there are questions coming in right now online. So thank you so much. And our next presenter is Dr. Alan Bryce. Dr. Bryce is Vice Chair, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Director, Genomic Oncology Service, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Dr. Bryce is going to address emerging diagnostic technologies, new treatment approaches, clinical trials, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Bryce.
Thank you, Carolyn. And thank you to all the patients who are on the line today. Hopefully you'll find this helpful and useful in your prostate cancer journey. There's certainly a lot going on in the field of prostate cancer, as Dr. Slovin has mentioned, and the advances in the past several years, I think, have really embarked us on a whole new era in prostate cancer compared to where we were a decade ago. And yet, the advances and the pace continue. And I think there's every reason to be optimistic that over the next several years we'll continue to see new treatments come online and new treatment paradigms get developed. Much of this is being derived from fundamental understanding of the biology of the disease, and some of this is being derived from improvements in technology. And genomics is the intersection of both of those things. So that is, we now have technology which allows us to sequence a genome very quickly. We can do that overnight, whereas we have the knowledge base to try to start to understand what that information means as far as what's driving a cancer and how that might benefit a patient. There's certainly advances in technology as far as imaging, which are quite relevant to the management of prostate cancer. So as I think many of the patients know, one of the questions that frequently comes up is, where is the cancer? A patient might have a rising PSA after surgery or after radiation, and whereas the PSA suggests that the cancer has come back very frequently, the scans will not show any evidence of disease, and so we have this state that was referred to earlier where we have biochemical recurrence. There are new and improving imaging modalities that you may have heard about. So, for example, we have PET choline scans, which recently improved in the United States, which is an improved PET scan which is able to pick up very low levels of prostate cancer cells. So in that patient where a CT scan or a technetium scan might show no evidence of disease, the choline PET scans have the ability to detect microscopic disease in lymph nodes as well as bones and help the patient and their physician understand better how extensive the disease is or isn't, and help inform treatment-making decisions. Because in that time when we have biochemical recurrence, it's frequently the best answer to not treat, if at all possible, or to consider perhaps trials or experimental therapies where the expectation of side effects is far less than what you might get from chemical castration. This is one of the major drivers of quality in life in our quality of life in our patients, and trying to limit the amount of time that the prostate cancer patient has to deal with chemical or surgical castration is one of the best ways we can preserve quality of life for as long as possible. There's other imaging modalities. There's fluorine PET scans as well. And fluorine compared to choline is perhaps less sensitive for lymph nodes, for soft tissue disease, but it's still very effective in looking at bone metastases that might be too subtle to be picked up on a more traditional technetium scan. And so these modalities are being widely applied both in the U.S. and Europe, and certainly offer the opportunity to get more detailed information to the patient and the physician in that treatment decision-making. Another space where one might think of this is right up front. When you're first diagnosed with prostate cancer, and an immediate question is it still limited to the prostate or has it spread further? Here again, the choline PET scans can be useful, because it has a very good ability to detect that microscopic lymph node disease that right now frequently only shows up in the surgical pathology after surgery's been done. And so knowing that information in advance can help refine the treatment decision-making. We're also very excited about the improvements in MRI imaging for prostate cancer. So I think it's quite commonplace now that patients will have a pelvic MRI with an endorectal coil, which gives us the best high-resolution image of the prostate prior to surgery to understand, is there any evidence that it invaded beyond the prostate, outside of the capsule or down to the seminal vesicles? Is it more localized to one side or the other? And this kind of information can help the surgeon in trying to plan the surgery. There are also emerging technologies in terms of preoperative risk prevention, and Dr. Slovin touched on this to some extent. So there are gene panel assays, for example, the one by Oncotype DX, similar to what is seen in breast cancer, which can tell the patient based upon their initial biopsy what the chances are for having bad pathology at the time of surgery or the chances are for having a PSA relapse, that biochemical recurrence, after surgery. And this information has been shown in clinical studies to add to the traditional predictors that we use, that is Gleason score and stage, to try and predict the patient's long-term risk. And here again, having that information can help the patient and his clinician decide on the best treatment approach. When one considers how slow prostate cancer can be in some patients, a better understanding of the individual risk for the patient can help drive decisions about should something even be treated or not. Because, of course, prostate cancer is most common in older men, and it's entirely possible that you might look at an individual situation and say, given the 10-year risk being as low as it is, the odds that something else is going to threaten the patient's life in the next 10 years far outweighs the prostate cancer. So let's avoid doing anything about it and try active surveillance. Other emerging technologies, we've had circulating tumor cells, which we've had for many years, pioneered out of Memorial Sloan Kettering. But our ability to work with these is enhanced. So recent data shows the value of something called ARV7, which is a particular variant of the testosterone receptor, the androgen receptor. And when this variant is present, it confers resistance to some of the new next-generation anti-androgen therapies, such as enzalutamide or abiraterone. And so knowing the patient has that resistance early on can help us avoid therapies that are not likely to be effective but are going to bring some level of side effects. The ability to detect these on circulating tumor cells means that we can know this information based on a blood draw without having to do a biopsy of the tumor itself. And that then leads into the kind of the next level of the liquid biopsy, which is really one of the frontiers in cancer at the moment, which is we do have the ability to do a blood draw from a patient, much as you would have for any of your regular blood tests, and extract tumor DNA from the blood. And that tumor DNA is the same concept where we're talking about precision oncology. We can understand what is going on in the tumor cell to make it cancerous and potentially then pick therapy on the basis of that information or refine our treatment recommendations on the basis of that information. So it's a very minimally invasive way to try and assess what is going on in that individual tumor in that patient at that point in time. And so these technologies are a big focus of the conversations we're having at our annual cancer research meeting that's ongoing right now in Philadelphia. At the same time, we have large amounts of data coming out from sequencing studies from the two Stand Up to Cancer Dream teams. So there's two large consortiums that are trying to delve deeply into the genetics of prostate cancer. And this includes circulating tumor cells and cell-free DNA. And we're understanding better the transition of aggressive from mild to aggressive prostate cancer. So that is, most men start out with this very hormone-dependent prostate cancer, which can take many years to develop. But as we successfully treat that, it'll slowly transition to increasingly aggressive forms, and at the far other end of the spectrum, we have a kind of prostate cancer that looks more like small cell lung cancer. And at that point, this disease tends to be highly aggressive, it spreads very rapidly, and it's entirely resistant to any hormone-based approach. We're really dependent on chemotherapy at that point. And what one of the Dream teams have recently reported just yesterday is that based upon genetic signatures, they can identify that transition at a much earlier stage than we're traditionally able to do. And if we can do that, or if we could even do it on cell-free DNA, then we'd have the ability to intervene and try and treat patients more aggressively earlier in their disease course before the disease gets out of hand. Because it's always best to treat aggressive disease when there's just a small amount of it rather than waiting till it's spread too widely. We're also beginning to understand at a genetic level something we've long suspected, which is that some of the major drivers of other cancers, that is, defects in DNA repair mechanisms, underlie prostate cancer as well. And so most people have heard about BRCA as an important gene in breast cancer. And we've long known that perhaps 1-2% of prostate cancers have, or prostate cancer patients have BRCA in their genetics. But data coming out of one of the Dream teams yesterday is showing us that defects in this pathway, this constellation of genes which BRCA is a part of, are present in perhaps as many as 40% of prostate cancer patients. And this is important because we have drugs developed in breast cancer that specifically target this group of patients, and this group of drugs is called PARP inhibitors. So now a new clinical trial is going to be shortly underway trying to apply these PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer, and it's our ability to really precisely define these patients to get them on this pathway, which is going to allow us to maximize the efficacy of the therapy. It not only allows us to give the right drug to the right patient, but it allows us to avoid giving this drug to the wrong patient as well, and thus avoid the side effects. In terms of other new treatment approaches, immunotherapy is also critically important, and Dr. Slovin on the line here is one of the world's experts on this topic. So immunotherapy is the other great advance in cancer treatment in general right now, along with genomics, and this involves using the immune system to attack cancer. Prostate cancer was, in fact, the first malignancy ever treated with ipilimumab, which was the first immunotherapy that was proven to work in melanoma. And while the similar prostate cancer trial came up disappointingly short of its target, there was enough activity there that we do believe that there is a population of patients who will benefit from this therapy. And so we are dedicating ourselves to the challenge of figuring out who that patient group is. Again, delivering the right drug to the right patient is how one can demonstrate the necessary benefit for government and regulatory agencies to accept a new therapy. Other new treatment approaches, vaccine approaches, continue to be developed. This is probably the third rail in cancer advance right now. And we've long had attempts at vaccine therapy in prostate cancer in the form of Prostvac and other similar drugs. So those studies are ongoing as well, and certainly we hope that we'll be able to add those drugs to the armamentarium in the not-too-distant future. So all that gets to the point that clinical trials are certainly critically important as we continue to try to move the field forward, and I'd certainly encourage patients to always have that conversation with their physician to say, is standard of care the right choice for me right now, or should I think about clinical trials? There are next-generation drugs across the spectrum of the disease, so we're still continuing to develop new hormonal therapies beyond enzalutamide and abiraterone. There's next-generation versions of these drugs in development currently. There's a large Phase 3 clinical trial looking at a next-generation drug called galetarone, which is trying to focus on these AR-V7 mutant patients. There's next-generation antiandrogens like ARN-509, which are specifically focused on this population of biochemically recurrent patients because many people believe that ARN-509 will be less toxic and provide a higher quality of life for patients than taking the traditional Lupron or Eligard type approach. And again, quality of life is fundamentally important here. Quality of life is integrated now into all of our clinical trials because when we're talking about a disease where we can reasonably hope to keep patients alive for a decade or more, or even decades, we have to focus on the quality that the patients have during that time. And it's all those side effects that this audience, I'm sure, is familiar with, the hot flashes, the weakness, the impact on libido and mood, the weight gain, and the metabolic changes. And all of these things impact the patient's long-term quality and the patient's long-term health beyond just what's going on with the cancer. So this is where, when we say precision medicine, it's not only being able to select the right drug, but it's also knowing when not to treat. It's also knowing when not to use certain drugs because they're not going to work, and thus avoiding the side effects that they bring. I encourage patients to be forthright with their physicians in terms of how their therapy is affecting their life, because in modern medicine, we absolutely emphasize collaborative decision-making between the patient and the physician. And, the physician can try as hard as he or she might to get information from the patient, but at the end of the day, we're still dependent upon what you're telling us and what we see with our own eyes. But there's lots of spaces, beyond what happens in the physician's office that we just can't understand without hearing it from you. So I'm going to stop there so we can get to question time and continue moving forward. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Bryce. Again, that was really just so comprehensive and so really excellent. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Well, there are questions actually coming in online right now. So there are definitely questions, lots of questions for both you and Dr. Slovin. And our next speaker is Mr. Richard Dickens. Mr. Dickens is an oncology social worker, and he's our Men's Cancers Program Director at Cancer Care. And Mr. Dickens is going to address the Cancer Care's free psychosocial support services and programs and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Mr. Dickens.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you to everybody on this call. Hearing the words, "you have cancer," is something no one ever forgets. Hearing the words, "you have prostate cancer," for men and those who love them raises its own unique set of concerns and introduces the patient and family to uncertainty and unwanted change, redefining who am I now and wondering who will I be after treatment. As jarring as these thoughts can be for millions of men have gotten to the other side and found stability and direction and comfort. For all men, it is a three-point process. The first point is education, which encompasses speaking to professionals, understanding your disease and treatment options, hearing from other prostate cancer patients. A good place to start is the internet. Helpful organizations such as Cancer Care can guide you through this process. Becoming a knowledgeable consumer goes a long way toward giving you a sense of control and making you an active member in your treatment decisions. Point number two is building or strengthening relationships, often defined as family and friends, workplace, medical team, house of worship, clubs, and groups. Let's start with your medical team. Don't be afraid to bring up any topic of concern. It's helpful to think of this as a partnership or collaboration. Your doctor and oncology team, which includes a nurse, social worker, and other specialists, can't treat a problem if you don't make them aware of it. They are experts in your cancer and treatment, but you are the expert of your body and life, so it is important to let them know when you have a question or something feels wrong. And finally, point three, self-care, often underlooked. A cancer diagnosis impacts people psychologically, physically, and often spiritually, which creates a lot of stress and pressure. With a new diagnosis, or if you are dealing with a recurrence, you usually have time before you must make medical decisions. Saying, "I need a day to think about this," can give you an opportunity to catch your breath and get feedback from loved ones and other resources. For people who care about you, helping is one thing they can give. That is why building a support network is so important. By reaching out to as many as possible, you help the caregivers to spread the help and thereby help themselves. A wonderful quote I heard recently is, "We can eat a whole elephant if we do it one bite at a time." Remember, self-care begins with breaking big problems into little pieces and addressing them one at a time. Cancer Care is oncology social workers who inform people of resources and strategies for finding help, which can include creating a phone tree or, for those who are computer savvy, a blog to keep people informed, or mind-body-spirit techniques such as meditation and imagery to calm the mind and relax the body during stress. Along with education and resources, Cancer Care provides counseling, regional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online support groups for patients and loved ones. Many patients and caregivers want to speak with others who are going through the same thing to find out how they are coping and what resources they found, as well as to be with others who really know what they are going through. Groups can provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation you're not alone. Along with Cancer Care, there are other organizations that help prostate cancer patients and families, such as Us2 International, which is a prostate-specific organization, and Immerman Angels or Cancer Hope Network, both of which connect patients to patients and caregivers to caregivers for one-on-one connections. For many, social supports, getting to know your healthcare team, education, and support groups go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenges of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. You can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673 and speak to a social worker or explore how we can help. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Rick. That was so eloquent and so helpful to everybody. Thank you very much for that, for your giving everyone all this information about the services and also about just coping with prostate cancer. Thank you. And now we have time for questions, and I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, Dr. Slovin and Dr. Bryce, and we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and again, we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If for some reason we don't get to your question, or you think of a question later on today or tomorrow or over the next couple of months, you can always call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that number again toward the end of the call. Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Our first question comes from Emil S. Your line is open.
Hi. Based on yesterday's article in the Times on blood DNA test, can a blood DNA test be used in the future as an alternative and a better indicator of prostate cancer, since there's been so much hype about the PSA exam? And can it also be used for metastatic prostate cancer? And can metastatic prostate cancer show up 10 to 15 years after you've been cured of, or supposedly cured of, prostate cancer through surgery?
Well, Emil, thank you. Good to have you on the call. I'm going to ask Dr. Slovin if you could address these two questions, and
actually,
Dr. Slovin will address them in a general way.
Yes, actually, I was going to turf this to Dr. Bryce, because he did such an eloquent job of talking about these DNA-based tests. Alan,
excellent.
Would you do that one?
Thank you, Dr. Bryce.
So the answer as far as cell-free DNA, circulating DNA, I think absolutely we're going to get there. So we are working on it, but I guess what I would emphasize is that as of, you know, today, as of 2015, this is still a research tool. So we've yet to apply this in a setting where it's been done in a prospective clinical trial, meaning we've actually done the experiment to prove it really works the way we think it does. Right now, this is still a test in development, I would say. But I absolutely expect that over the next few years, you're going to see those studies planned and come together where we're collecting the cell-free DNA moving forward to do exactly what you said, which is apply it to really every state of the disease. Can we be better than PSA in terms of saying, you know, who's actually got prostate cancer versus who just has a rising PSA? Can we monitor metastatic disease better when the patient's on treatment than with PSA? So the answer is yes, that's where we're moving, but no, we're not there as of today.
I would just say, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And then, I'm sorry, what was the second question?
I think the second question had to do with the metastatic disease in terms of prognostication. So if you've had purportedly cured,
that's right.
Would these be helpful in the future?
Well, and then the question was, can it come back 10 to 15 years later? And the answer is yes, absolutely. I mean, prostate cancer is a disease where, you know, relapse can happen many years after initial treatment, yes.
The one thing I would mention to our listeners is that a lot of the tests that we're discussing have not been validated in clinical trials, meaning that they are not approved by the FDA, and we don't know if they are going to be helpful unless we do it on very large populations. So we ask our listeners to be very circumspect in going forward with asking their doctors to do these tests, because they're just not ready for prime time. They're still research, as Dr. Bryce mentioned.
Excellent. Thank you. Now, we have a question from one of our online participants, and that question is there a current consensus on when to begin hormone therapy for rising PSA following primary treatment? If so, what is the consensus? Thanks.
I'm going to take that one.
Okay.
So it's an area that's near and dear to me. Well, first of all, when someone has a rise in PSA after primary therapy, such as surgery or radiation, we call that a biochemical relapse. PSAs that are going up, for example, from 2 to 4 does not mean that you have twice the amount of disease at 4 compared with 2. It's just a matter that the disease is active. There still remains a challenge in treating patients who have a biochemical relapse. We do not have a consensus because there really is no standard of care. If you go back to the 1990s, just about every urologist whose patient failed the primary treatment with surgery and had a rising PSA, all these patients went on to hormonal therapy. And at the end of 2 years, all they were doing when their cancer started to recur in the setting of, again, another rise in PSA, is literally have just resistance to multiple therapies, have no evidence of disease anywhere on imaging. And all we did was treat numbers, and we were just busy scratching our heads. Should we give chemo? Should we try to do something else? We have a lot of different therapies, but frankly, there is no standard. So if you were to do intermittent hormones or do single agent anti-androgens or do nothing until there is a rapid change in the PSA, meaning doubling or tripling very quickly, there really are no data to support doing any one particular treatment over another. And again, sometimes just diet alone may cause some modulation in PSA, reduction in fat, alcohol, et cetera, can actually impact on the PSA. So I wish I could say there is a definite consensus, but the jury is still out, and anything goes. So you really, this is something that you need to discuss with your doctor.
Excellent. Thank you. Excellent. And so we do recommend that you go back to your treating healthcare team. Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Stephanie Kay. Your line is open.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for this wonderful seminar. I have two questions. My husband has a number 5 of his surveillance. He's actively surveillanced. His 5 is Gleason score. And I wanted to know more information about that. And he does go to the VA. And number 2 is about the choline PET scan and the flowing PET scan. Is that for prime time right now? And does the VA have that?
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask our speakers to address these questions in a general way.
Okay. Alan, you want to take the choline and the fluorine or?
Yeah, I'm happy to address. I mean, certainly these tests are currently available and are being widely used. So, I mean, this isn't research. This is very much currently accepted care. I don't know if your VA has it. And fluorine PET is widely available. Right now, choline PET is not widely available. In fact, when choline PET was first approved by the FDA, it was only approved to be given at the Mayo Clinic. And the reason for that is that choline the way it's manufactured, it's an isotope. And so with all these PET scans, what this means is you have a molecule on which we've placed a radioactive tracer or a tag that then lights up when the scan, when the patient is scanned, and that's how we see the tumor. But the issue is that the choline isotope is actually very unstable. It only lasts for about 20 minutes before it just degrades back to regular choline, which is a vitamin. And so the isotope actually has to be manufactured on site, and that means that the facility has to have a cyclotron and have a certain level of good manufacturing practices and certification. And so at the time the FDA approval was given, Mayo was the only place that had that level of certification. Fluorine PET, on the other hand, that isotope is very stable, has a much longer half-life, so it'll be centrally produced at some facility or factory, and they ship to medical centers around the country. So that's certainly widely available. And I can't speak to your particular VA if it's available or not, but certainly it is being reimbursed and paid for by insurance companies.
I think the other question had to deal with Gleason 5 and surveillance. I'm not really clear what the question was. Really, what dictates whether or not somebody has active surveillance is the PSA, the Gleason score, and the number of cores that are involved. So if your husband is still having either negative biopsies or the number of cores that are involved with Gleason 5 or the percent involvement has remained stable, then active surveillance is very appropriate. It's only if the Gleason score changes or more disease becomes involved within the gland or we start to see that the PSA is doubling or tripling very rapidly, would the recommendation to do surgery or radiation then become a reality.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants from Denise. When should an African-American male with a family history be tested? What does the test entail, meaning invasive or blood work? Dr. Slovin, could you address this really in detail so that people hear about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an excellent question. I mean, we do know that there are family histories of prostate cancer. The fact that if your father has it conveys a twofold risk to you. If your father, grandfather, or brother, for example, has it, your sons will have up to an eightfold risk of prostate cancer. The American Urologic Association and the American Cancer Society feel that patients with high risk, i.e. family history, should at least start their screening at 40. The American Cancer Society feels that for patients who are at ethnic risk, either by family history or just by the fact that they're African American, for example, start at 45. I would say that most of us, even though those are guidelines, are often making recommendations to have people evaluated for screening, which is mainly a blood test for PSA, in addition to a digital rectal examination, as early as 35. And in some cases where there's an extensive family history, even 30, because you can even start seeing on biopsies of patients with very significant family histories. And I'm not just talking about a father, but there's been lineages, you know, groups of patients with, you know, families of grandfather, great-grandfather, et cetera, where if you look at somebody who doesn't really have prostate cancer but is a close relative, you'll start to see changes within the prostate. That being said, the only way we would be monitoring both situations of either family history or somebody at high ethnic risk would be to do a PSA either semi-annually or annually along with a digital rectal examination. We would not go in there prophylactically to do a biopsy to look for any early changes because there's no data that that's of any consequence at this time. And unfortunately, we're still not ready for the prime time for some of those other very interesting tests that Dr. Bryce has previously alluded to.
A very important question. It's one that I know many people are concerned about on this call. We have another question from one of our telephone participants.
Our next question comes from Mark S. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. I was listening to yours. It's a great conference. Very upsetting because I don't want to get upset right here, but I mean it's upsetting. So, because I didn't know that it could come back in 10 to 15 years. I had prostate cancer in 2007, and I wonder what the statistics are of it coming back just generally after you've had radiation and radiation therapy and the seed implant. Is there any way of finding that out?
Yeah. Mark, that's an excellent question, and we want to put this in a context. So I'm going to ask both our physicians to comment on this so that you actually, because you know you came on the call to get some information and then you hear something, we want to be sure that you understand the context of that. Dr.
Yes.
Slovin, could you address it first and Dr. Bryce second?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for your question. Believe me, it was unintentional that we in any way wanted to upset you or put you at greater concern than you already have with anxiety. You know, we deal as medical oncologists with the idea that we can control disease, and there is a significant population or proportion of men, probably greater than 90% to 95%, who are quote-unquote cured, although I'll be very blunt and tell you I don't like to use the word cure. I like to use the word remission, and if that lasts until the day you die, by all means call it a cure. There are patients who are at risk of their disease coming back, meaning that if your disease was confined to the gland, there was nothing in the surgical margin or in the capsule, the seminal vesicle, or the lymph node, that the likelihood of your being in a permanent remission is extremely high. What we are just talking about, there are some patients who have other either histologic appearances of their cancer, meaning their cancer looks very aggressive at the get-go, that may portend that it may come back to say hello to us again, either in the form of a PSA many years, months to years later. So I'm just trying to keep this very general, but again, it's really highly dependent on how aggressive your cancer was, how high the PSA was at diagnosis, how the radiation was performed, the dose of the radiation. But I would tell you right now that your radiation oncologist will guarantee you almost probably a 90 to 95% chance of being possibly cured. I say possible because it's cancer, and we do know that childhood malignancies are cured very easily. Adult cancers are just sometimes harder to put into a durable state, but you should have no trouble if, in fact, that the all these parameters were really at low levels. Dr. Bryce?
And Dr. Bryce, do you want to add to that? Because here's someone who's been disease-free since 2007, and so if you just want to comment, just to put it in a context for everybody on the call, and of course, and the concept of going back to your treating healthcare team with any questions. But.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with what Dr. Slovin is saying, which is, you know, whereas we do think that for all intents and purposes, you know, most men can at least consider themselves cured because they'll reach the end of their natural life without the prostate cancer coming back, there's still always the exceptions to the rule, and there's still always those men where it comes back. And so, you know, we do get into a bit of this conversation about what's a cure and what's a remission, and it can cause a lot of anxiety. So I certainly appreciate, you know, where the patient is coming from, and I do apologize that, you know, it's anxiety-provoking in that sense. In terms of being very specific, I mean, your radiation oncologist, I'm sure, can actually sit down and look at the particular details of what happened and say, you know, I can show you based upon, say, we have clinical calculators and some data that your risk of this coming back is specifically X, you know, generate some kind of a number or whatnot if that would help. The good news, I think, that hopefully provides some reassurance is in the vast majority of cases, with very few exceptions, you know, we will have a hint that the disease is coming back through PSA testing long before it's ever symptomatic. You know, it's very unusual that the disease will start to cause pain or symptoms or some kind of decline before the PSA is going up. So you know, if that's not already happening, then the reassurance is that nothing is imminent. You know, when this process happens, it's a process that tends to play out over the course of many years. So there isn't an urgency to saying, you know, I have to go back in and kind of have or change how I'm approaching my life, I suppose, as long as one remains involved with their physician.
And so what we would recommend is that you actually probably, because you have this information today, that you would contact your physician and actually set up an appointment with them and go over all the details of your specific situation. And that's true for everyone on the call, because indeed, although you're getting general information today, the specifics of it is best handled, of course, by your own treating team. And, of course, we do these programs to provide you with information, but not to create upset or anxiety. So I would definitely recommend that you just go ahead and call your physician, and they probably can address your concerns and questions very directly. And I think, as Dr. Bryce and Dr. Slovin said, can give you those particulars that can help you to just get on with where you were before you heard this information. So that's really important. So I hope that helps you. And also, if you do have further concerns, please do call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. We'll speak with one of our social workers here who can really help to address that as well, because we certainly don't want people to be what we call the worried well. We want you to feel confident in getting on with your life. That's really important, too. The quality of life issue is so important, I think, as Dr. Bryce has alluded to. So now we have another question. We have actually a lot of questions today. This is a very informed audience, very excellent questions, I have to say. So here's a question. If you failed ABI and ENZO, how is ACTC going to help? You likely have the ARV7 mutation. What further help would ACTC provide? Dr. Bryce, would you like to address that one?
Yeah, so I think in current clinical practice, when we talk about standard of care, once you've progressed beyond really at that point all the available androgen pathway inhibitors, we're really thinking in terms of chemotherapy or probably radium-223 as the standard of care options that remain at that point. Does a CTC in current practice provide the critical information that points us in one direction or another? I would say no. In my practice, it's another helpful piece of information, but the scenario you just described, I think we know so much in that scenario that probably the CTC is not critical to saying, you know, do I think the patient should get one treatment or another. Where CTCs are currently most useful is as a very early prognostic marker, which is to say the change in the circulating tumor cell levels over the early course of therapy has been shown to be very meaningful in terms of translating into the patient's outcomes. But in terms of the treatment decision-making up front, no, that's not where I would apply it.
If I can just add one little factor, I think what often ends up being very confusing to patients is that we have for many years relied on changes in bone scan and CAT scan. We also see patients whose scans may remain absolutely stable, but their PSAs may be going up or down. And the problem is, how does that reflect on the biology of the cancer? For many years when we were doing drug development, our major concern was to try to figure out what drug is worthy of further development. And when we looked at certain parameters such as PSA, we found that many drugs were being discarded very early on because it didn't seem to have an impact on the PSA. And we completely did not have other parameters by which we could determine the impact on the biology of the cancer. So looking at circulating tumor cells and other venues or methodologies are trying to answer that question, meaning that if your scans are just not as clear as we think they should be, they're either slightly worse or stable, but you are feeling better overall and you're eating better, you're doing more, you have no pain, that's implying that there's something about the drug that indicates that it's active. But we need to show through a biologic level, if not relevant to the scans, that it's working. And that's where the CTCs are coming in, the cell-free DNA, all of that is trying to be associated with a change in the biology so that we can ultimately use it as a relevant marker or biomarker for a change in the behavior of that cancer.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So now we have another question from one of our online participants, actually from Dominic. Galatrone trial had an exclusion of prior use of Enzo or AB, and the question is what happens if the person was really not able to benefit from either Enzo or AB? Dr. Bryce, can you address that?
Yeah, so when a patient has progressed after both enzalutamide and abiraterone, I mean, clinically speaking, I would say we're really in a mode of thinking about chemotherapy if we're talking standard of care. Otherwise, we're talking about clinical trials. And that is to say, you know, there's this transition I was referring to between that hormone-dependent cancer, whether it's high hormone levels or low hormone levels. Early in the course of the disease, prostate cancer is very much driven by this hormone pathway. But as it progresses and it moves beyond all of our therapies, it ends up looking a lot more like other cancers, just general carcinoma that's really not dependent on hormones. And you know, at that point, we're past Emma, past Abby, past Enza, you know, the likelihood of being at that state keeps increasing with each subsequent line of therapy. So clinical trials are absolutely something we consider in this space. Chemotherapy, again, is something one has to think about. Personally, I would be less enthusiastic about thinking about another androgen pathway inhibitor, such as galatrone.
Well, I want to thank our speakers. You have been extraordinary. This is an amazing team, I have to say. Thank you both to Dr. Slovin, Dr. Bryce, and Mr. Dickens. I also want to thank all of you as participants on this call today. You have really asked extraordinary questions, amazing questions, and all of you who've been listening. I do want to remind all of you that for all the questions that we addressed today, that you take that information back to your healthcare team so they can actually apply it to your specific situation. That is really very important to do. And also, I do want to remind all of you that although this workshop is soon to end, nevertheless, all the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those continue always for you. And I don't want anyone to leave this program today thinking that you're alone in coping with prostate cancer or in coping with cancer in general. I want you to now know that you are part of the Cancer Care world of community and that we have a large staff of oncology social workers who are here to talk with you to provide both practical and financial assistance as well as support groups on the telephone and online as well as counseling or just someone to talk to. We also have other workshops like this coming up, of course, on many different topics, and there is a part two to this series. I just want to remind you that there is a part two, and the part two of this program is on May 12th, and it's Advances in the Treatment of Metastatic Prostate Cancer, so stay tuned, and some of you may be signing up or have already signed up for that program as well. In addition, we have lots of publications and a very robust website. So, again, I urge you to take advantage of all of these free services, and you can simply call us at 1-800-813-4673 and contact our staff here at Cancer Care. Again, 1-800-813-4673. I want to thank you all for your participation today. You have been an extraordinary audience of participants, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.